This is Rob Stoner from Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review and Don McLean's American Pie. You're listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast with Robert Miller.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners worldwide in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. My guest today is Arno Hecht, the acclaimed tenor saxophonist and the founding member of the Uptown Horns, the New York City-based horn section that has recorded or toured with a who's who of the music world, including the Rolling Stones, James Brown, Chuck Berry, Robert Plant, Ray Charles, Joe Cocker, and many more. And Arno has played on the B-52's Love Shack, James Brown's Living in America, Billy Joel's River of Dreams, Joe Cocker's Unchain My Heart, and the soundtrack to Rocky IV, among many others. What a list. And in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musical guests, Arno and I are going to do a song fest. We're going to play a bit of a number of these songs that we've just talked about, and you're going to get the backstories, and nobody else does this in podcasts. And you know that I like to feature a song of mine in every episode, underneath the introduction and at the end. And I always try to make that song relevant somehow. And in this episode, I have chosen my song called Yeah Yeah from the album PGS 7 by my band Project Grand Slam. I chose this song because it's got a smoking tenor sax on it, just like Arno. So Arno Hecht, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast, baby.
Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. You know, I was reading through this list of who you have played with, both in the Uptown Horns and on your own. And I'm saying to myself, did you ever think that you like died and went to heaven, that these are the people you played with?
Definitely. I've gotten to play with a whole bunch of my heroes from going way back. There have been moments where I've just sort of like, wow, this is great. I could die now.
Exactly. There's nothing more to do. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in New York, in Queens.
In Queens. Another Queens boy. See, this is why I liked you immediately. Okay? I'm from Queens myself. This is kismet that we've met like this.
Yes.
Okay. So what was the moment when you knew you wanted to be a musician?
Well, I didn't realize I was actually going to get to do it, but the very first time I don't mind telling this story. I was like 12 years old. And, you know, I'd already had a couple of years playing clarinet and I'd started on sax. And I was at my first school. I was in seventh grade. I was at my first school dance. And it was one of those classic things where, like, you know, all the boys were lined up on one side of the gym. And then there was that great chasm and all the girls are on the other.
And they're waiting for the boys to come ask them to dance, right?
Right. You know, and you're sort of standing there going like, what if I ask her to dance? And like, she laughs at me or something. And meanwhile, there was a band that was probably about like, you know, 3 years older than us or something. And they were on stage and they looked like they were having the greatest time. And I distinctly remember thinking, I'd way rather be up there than down here right now. That's when it first started.
I totally get it. And I'm sure that it was a cover band, right? Because back then, everybody was like a garage band, a cover band.
Oh, sure. Nobody, you know, like we were, you know, like 15 years old or whatever. You know, they weren't doing originals. They were doing, you know, whatever the hits were at the time.
What was on the radio? You know, one of the great things about growing up in New York City, I've talked about this before in the podcast, on the AM dial of the radio, we had three great rock and roll stations, if you remember.
Sure.
You had WMCA with the Good Guys, WABC with Cousin Brucey, who was my first guest on the podcast.
Oh, wow.
And a dear friend. And then you had WINS with Mia Zuri, the key is A, Murray the K.
Yes.
But You know, the great thing was during that great era of the British invasion, the 60s, et cetera, you could surf from one station to the next and just hear one great song after another, couldn't you?
There were a lot of great songs, yeah.
Was that the era when you came of age as well?
Yeah, that was definitely my age. You know, I was still like in junior high when the Beatles first appeared. And of course, like everybody else, I was like, wow, these guys are really cool.
Changed the world, didn't it?
In fact, my first song I played on the, when I picked up, you know, I kept playing clarinet, but when I first picked up the sax, the very first song I played was Tequila.
By the Champs.
By the Champs, that's right.
That's right. What a great song, huh?
Still play it.
Did you have a high school band?
I had bands like, first band I was in, I was 13 years old. And all through high school and college, that's what I did. You know, I played in different bands and we did the rounds, you know, playing church and synagogue dances and Sweet 16s and stuff like that.
There you go. That was it. I just told this story recently. The first gig that I ever had, I played at a Boy Scout luncheon and we got paid in cheeseburgers. How about
there
that?
There you go.
All right. So, you know, listen, I got to ask you the question. You went to tenor sax off of the clarinet.
Well, the first one I played was alto, but then I switched to tenor because tenor was more my voice, I guess. So,
did you start with the clarinet because that was what was used in the high school band and orchestra?
No, not at all. I was in fifth grade, 10 years old when I started. You know, I was a fan of Benny Goodman's, and my folks had been like heavy duty classical buffs. So, you know, like there's a famous Mozart clarinet concerto, you know, and stuff like that. I don't know. You know, I remember my dad died when I was young, but then I asked my mom, like, could I want to take clarinet lessons. And so I did.
All right. So you started on clarinet.
As they say, like, I studied privately.
Did you take formal lessons or did you pick it up by yourself?
Oh, no, it was formal lessons. I mean, you know, I had a teacher who came to my house every Saturday morning, and, you know, I learned.
I started out on the trumpet. I've told this story before. My father played the trumpet. I started playing the trumpet, and I played trumpet throughout junior high and high school in the band and the orchestra. But like we were saying, when the Beatles came out, as I've said, the trumpet suddenly wasn't very cool any longer. So everybody had to switch to guitar.
Well, it depends. You know, I had friends, and in fact, I was one of them, you know, who was a big Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass fan. And then, of course, you know, there was all that great Motown stuff and Stax stuff with horns.
You're right about that. All right, I got to ask you the question. If you were a Herb Alpert fan, what was the greatest cover in the mid-60s that Herb Alpert had on his album?
Well, he had a bunch, but of course, A Taste of Honey was one of the...
I'm talking about the cover, not the music. It was the cover that sold a million records.
Oh, the cover. Oh, well, Whipped Cream and Other Delights.
There you go.
Every guy's fantasy.
For anybody that doesn't know what we're talking about, Herb Alpert had this great album, and it had a bunch of number ones, but boys didn't care about that. It had a great picture on the cover of a woman that was covered in whipped cream.
Yes, and boy, was she sexy as hell.
Yeah, exactly. That cover must have sold a million records just on the cover alone.
I've been told that it's probably not true, and it's one of those things. But someone told that they asked Herb Alpert, they said, I just want to ask you one question. And without blinking, he just said, the answer is yes.
All right. So tell me about the transition from you're playing saxophone, you got your high school bands and all of that stuff. And then you formed the Uptown Horns. Tell us about that.
Well, like I said, I played all through college. In fact, I was a history major. Even though I always played in bands, I always figured, you know, I'm going to end up being a lawyer or a history prof or something. But by the time I graduated, I was like, I don't want to go to grad school. I don't want to go to law school. I like playing the sax. So I kept playing in different bands and stuff. And then somewhere around the late 70s, I kind of recruited like three other guys, including a buddy of mine from college on trombone, who Paul Berman, who went on to become a famous writer. And that was the original Uptown Horns. And we were together for a couple of years and did stuff playing around like the New York scene, playing with John Parris, playing with the Dicey Ross Blues Band. But we kind of drifted apart for different reasons.
You gravitated up into the upper echelon of the rock and roll world with these different artists that you were playing with. How did that happen?
It was a gradual thing. I met basically the current lineup. We had one change after 12 years. And we were all coming out of like a rock and roll thing. A lot of horn players are like straight ahead jazz. But we all related to rock and R&B. And Bob Funk, our trombone player and stuff. So we started doing some things together. And then our very first album, and we had already been, each been doing like a certain amount of like studio work and so on. Our first album credit as the Uptown Horns, and I still think this is cool, was an Iggy Pop's party album.
Iggy Pop, wow.
And that was the beginning. And so we started getting, Iggy Pop and Holly and the Italians. I did some stuff with Willie Nile. And then we used to run a weekly Tuesday jam at the original Tramps on East 15th Street. And we had like our original keyboard player was Charlie Giordano, who's now a member of Springsteen Eat Street Band, and Mark Rebo on guitar, who went on to considerable fame in his own right. And we would get together like early on like a Tuesday afternoon and work up some of our own stuff. And then we'd always arrange to have like say three special invited guests who would come by to the rehearsal, and they would like want to do, could we do this song? Could we do that song? And so we'd end up working. I mean, you name it, we did it. We had like, instrumental version of Devo's Whip It. We did Goldfinger. And so we did this for a year and a half. And so like, after the rehearsal, we'd break for dinner, come back. We'd start the night with an hour of our own stuff up front with our band. And then do a short break. And then the jam part would happen. And we had like some of the wildest stuff. We had Ronnie Spector and Darlene Love doing a duet together. One night we had Iggy Pop, Southside Johnny, Mitch Ryder, and David Johansen all on stage doing Good Golly Miss Molly. The Neville Brothers were in town working on one of their albums, and they came by and sat in, and you name it, people would come, and we would do these jams until the cops would come in and say, like, guys, it's like, after 4 in the morning, you really have to call it quits.
That's awesome. But tell me, how did you jump up from there to, the Rolling Stones or something? That's a quantum leap.
It was a very gradual sort of thing. In fact, while we were doing our jam at Tramps, and the Giles Band, Jay Giles Band was coming back from Europe, opening for the Stones. And they were like at the top of their game at that point with the Freeze Frame album, the one that had Centerfold on it and stuff. My blood runs cold. And they were looking to do a little tour and live album out of the tour, the Showtime album. So Seth Justman came down and he checked us out. And the next thing you know, we were on the road and recording with the Kyles band.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. As a musician and composer, I've crossed multiple genres. My early work includes jazz rock instrumentals like Spring Dance. And ballads like Ma Petite Fleur. Later on, I segued into vocal songs like Redemption Road.
But I'll come back strong, trying to stay on Redemption Road. I try to rise, make you surprise, Redemption Road.
And along the way, I added collaborations with world-class musicians like Jim Peterik, Elliot Randall, and Tony Carey on The Fall of Winter.
He said, stand tall to yourself, be true. Don't let the fall of winter get the best of you. Had a voice like a boat from the blue. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you.
I also pride myself on the reimagined covers I've done, including The In Crowd.
I'm in with The In Crowd. I go where The In Crowd goes. I'm in with The In Crowd. And I know what The In Crowd knows. Yeah, yeah.
And then recently, I've come full circle with The Rich Ones, a jazz instrumental with guest artist Randy Brecker. For me, crossing genres helps keep the music fresh. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast, and keep on rocking. All right, hold on right there, because it's a good segue from there into that Songfest that we're going to do. And right now I'm playing underneath Land of a Thousand Dances, which you did with the Jay Giles Band. Tell me about that.
Oh, well, it was amazing. We, they were just like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years older than us. And we were all coming from the same place. Musically, we had a lot of the same tastes. And it was one of those amazing experiences where we just sort of clicked musically and on a personal level. So, there they were, like, they were huge. I mean, it was like quintuple platinum album or something like that. And the vibe was like, hi, guys, welcome to the band.
You know, what's interesting to me is I went to a college in Boston, and Jay Giles Band came out of Boston. And they were like the big bar band, if you will, for a time in Boston.
Of course.
Then they made it. They got to the top. All right, let's go to the next one. You play with Ray Charles. I can't believe that. We're playing now Mess Around.
Too.
Tell me about that. That must have been an awesome experience playing with Ray Charles.
Yes, I'll tell you a good one from that one. So for years, for 3-4 years, whatever, people would say to me, well, you played with so many people and stuff. Who would you still like to play with? And without like hesitating for a second, I would automatically say, Ray Charles and B.B. King. Ray Charles and B.B. King. And the odds of getting to play with either of them were pretty long because they had their touring band. And when they recorded, they would record. We were already, at that point, we had already done a bunch of stuff. But we were, when they recorded, they didn't necessarily record in New York. And whoever their producers were, weren't people who we had some sort of relationship with. So the chance of getting to play with either of them was pretty far. And then suddenly we're on this gig, the Legends of Rock and Roll concert, which was like this huge deal. And suddenly there I was getting to play with both of them on the same show.
That must have been awesome, huh?
It was one of the thrills of my lifetime.
I can imagine. All right, let's go to the next one. This is another one that was just super. Paul Simon was introducing Dion, and I guess they both played on The Wanderer, which was Dion's big hit. Tell us about that one.
At this point for, 16, 17 years or something, I've been playing with Dion. I had played on his Yo Frankie album, which came out after he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. But I had never, played out live with him. That was just like I played on this one cut, Drive All Night, in the studio. And, the guy, what can I say? The guy's fantastic. So I've been playing with him for a bunch of years. And then they had this 25th anniversary Rock and Roll Hall of Fame show. And it was actually a great format. They would have Hall of Fame people and bands and stuff do like a mini set. And then the people, those bands would bring out special guests to guest with the band. So like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash ended up having Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Browne, and Stevie Wonder had Sting and B.B. King. And it was like one of those type things. So Paul Simon, who's a big Dion fan, ended up having Dion as one of his special guests. And it was like, the idea, so Dion came out and it was Paul Simon and his band doing backup vocals for Dion. And because, obviously The Wanderer was one of Dion's big hits. And since it had that famous sax solo, Dion had me take part and stuff. And that was, of course, like a lot of fun.
That's pretty awesome. All right, we're going to go to another one. Now, this is the one you played with the Stones that you sent me, Harlem Shuffle. Tell me about this one.
Great story. The Stones, it had been 8 years since they had played out, and there were a lot of rumors that maybe things were over between them and stuff, but they weren't. And so they decided they had this album out, the Steel Wheels album, and they were doing this big tour. And because they hadn't played out in all that time, they were definitely looking to pull out the stops and let the world know, we're back and we're bad and we haven't gone anywhere. So one day my phone rings. I pick up the phone. It was Jagger.
Really?
Who I'd met a couple of times very briefly, but, you know, just like, you know, I know this is Mick Jagger, Mick, you know. And he went into this very, like, weird rap about why the Stones weren't going to want horns on the tour. And so he's going, well, you know how it is when you do a tour. People say, why not get horns? And then why not get percussion? Why not hire a whole orchestra and stuff? And I'm agreeing with him. I'm going, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't hire horns either if I were you. But then at the end of this whole rap, he said to me, what if we did want horns? Would you guys be available? I was like, yeah, I think we could work it out.
Yeah, we might be able to fit you in.
We might be able to do that. So then, like, 2 months go by and not a word. And it was like, you know, among the Uptown Horns, like it was like a running gag for us. You know, we'd be like, you know, well, it was nice enough to at least to call and tell us why they weren't going to want horns. And then 9 days, you know, and meanwhile, like, you know, you're hearing all this, since it was a big deal tour, you're hearing all this stuff about, like, you know, in the news about, like, you know, the upcoming tour and stuff. 9 days before the tour started, he called back and he said, well, if we get you a tape, that was one of the days of cassette tapes still.
Right.
If we get you a tape with these like 11 songs, could you guys work out the horn parts and then come down and play for us? Like, yeah, I think we can manage to do that. So we did. So like the tape, you know, message to my house, the guys came over to my house, we worked out the part. And then like Monday, that was like a Friday or something. Monday, we went down to Nassau Coliseum, which they had rented out as their rehearsal space.
Just like every band does, right?
Yeah. And it's because like the Steel Wheels stage was so big,
right,
that like, you know, it only about like half of it fit into like Nassau Coliseum. Because it was like we were doing all arenas for that tour.
Yes.
And so we played with them the next day. I negotiated business with their business guy. And the day after that, we're heading down to Philly to like go on the road for over a year.
Wow. What a great story. All right. One more. I mentioned it in the introduction, and that is you played on the B-52's Love Shack, okay? Which was a wild song and a big, big hit. Tell me about that. That must have been fun.
That was fun. We went into the studio, you know, a lot of the stuff we do, we call head charts. You know, sometimes people want you to write stuff out and it, you know, they send you a tape. They want you to write something out in advance. Sometimes, you know, they have charts written out and you go to the studio and you read what they give you. But a lot of stuff that we do, and one of the reasons people can call us, is because we can work out things as head charts.
They're relying upon your creativity.
Yeah, you know, and you try different ideas, and what do you think of this, and how's this voicing? And I mean, Living in America, which I know we can get to, was a head chart. You know, we just made it up as we went along. So with Love Shack, that's what we did. And I remember like when we left the studio and we're walking out after having done the session, I remember saying to them specifically, you know, it's like a really kind of quirky song, but there's something about it. I could see it like actually being a hit. I don't always call them right, but I called that one.
Well, you're right about that. It was quirky as can be, but it was a big hit. And you know what? Arno Hecht and the Uptown Horns were a big hit as well, and still are. We have been speaking here with the great Arno Hecht. Arno, I want to thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Robert.
All right, we're going to listen now to that song that started off the episode. It's my song called Yeah, Yeah. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com.